Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting. Good morning, everyone. It's the 4th of September, the day after Labor Day, and I suppose, sadly enough, that means that summer is mostly in the rearview mirror. Good news, however, is the sun will still rise this morning, and the Son of God, Jesus Christ, has risen, and so we're part of a kingdom that has no end. We celebrate this wonderful good news every time we start our day together here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Glad to be joined in studio after the long weekend by the familiar names of Logan Rausch and Paul Perreault, who make sure things run smoothly during our 2 hours together. Really do lean on them throughout the morning as we cover the news and important topics, not with an allegiance, hopefully, to a Democratic or Republican, liberal or conservative standpoint, but rather from a Christian view. And we do it, hopefully, with authenticity and complexity and hopefully a bit of fun. So looking forward to our first hour ahead, I love our Tuesday mornings, joined first by Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation out of Washington, D.C., who's my conversation partner on the news and gives us an in-depth ground zero look at the events coming out of our nation's capital. And, of course, the confirmation hearings of a new Supreme Court Justice, Judge Kavanaugh, are starting up today. I'll get Tommy's thoughts on that. And he can riff on that and also the sublime. We love having him with us on these Tuesday mornings. And in the second half of this hour, we got Dr. Dale Gentry, a biochemistry professor. I'm not entirely sure what that means to be a biochemist, but he is one of those at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. And I wanted to have Dr. Gentry in the studio because I know around the Minneapolis St. Paul area where we broadcast from, it's been pretty hazy over the last few weeks, and that's the impact of wildfires going on around our country. So wanted to get his perspective. That's his expertise and background. But before bringing Tommy and later Dale into the show, if you listen to Faith Radio Mornings regularly, you know I'm quite a pushover for a great theological quote from the past. I think it somehow reminds me that this kingdom is much bigger than our lives and that will surely remain well after we all are gone. And so today's thought comes from the great second century theologian Tertullian, who writes this about prayer. Says, prayer cleanses us from sin. It drives away temptations. It stamps out persecutions and comforts the faint-hearted. It gives new strength to the courageous, brings travelers safely home, calms the waves, confounds the robbers, feeds the poor, overrules the rich, lifts up the fallen, supports those who are falling, and sustains those who stand firm. Those are quotes from almost 1,900 years ago from somebody following Jesus. Even at that time, we're part of a big story. And so maybe at some point today, simply pause and pray and maybe find yourself connected with thousands of years of followers that have been doing the same thing that we are doing here on Faith Radio Mornings with all of you, following Jesus the best we can as we walk through this world. We are part of a very big story. And with that, we'll welcome Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation next into the program on Faith Radio Mornings.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey.
I love that music. That takes me back into my childhood when I would wake up eagerly and anxiously on those Saturday mornings, which was the only time we could watch cartoons. It wasn't 24/7 on the Nickelodeon network or anything like that. We had to wait, and during the breaks between maybe the Flintstones or whatever we were watching, would come on Schoolhouse Rock and I'm Just a Bill. I looked forward to that every week. Tommy, you've brought my childhood back into play these days. Good morning.
I love it.
You know, I went to the Pooh movie yesterday, and that was during Labor Day with my family. That, too, what is it with all this nostalgia, Tommy? I mean, I love the Schoolhouse Rock. I love the Winnie the Pooh movies. I love everything that's happening where I feel like I'm 7 years old again.
You know, I get really nostalgic around back-to-school time, too. It's one of those, the times when you were a kid where you have the strongest emotions, and back-to-school was certainly a very highly emotional time. I think when you're an adult, you get very nostalgic about it. Lately this week, I've been nostalgic about back-to-school, trying to finish your summer reading, going shopping for school supplies, and getting to see all your old friends again, high school football games on Friday night, all that stuff. I love it.
Yeah, it's been really fun. We've got five kids, too, and just kind of started the starting school piece of it, you know. And I just think about those parents that this week maybe are putting their kids on the bus for the first time and waving goodbye. I mean, that's really a big moment in somebody's life.
Absolutely. We have a two-year-old, and he's going to preschool. And we went to the orientation last Thursday night, and I could see little tears in my wife's eyes. You know, they grow up too fast. It hurts.
It does. I know. It's like, I thought they were just, you know, a couple of years old, and now my son's off to university life. It's incredible. Well, nothing makes us more nostalgic, Tommy, than confirmation hearings out of Washington, D.C. You know, we're talking about the Supreme Court this week. There's a lot of news coming out of your neck of the woods. And Judge Kavanaugh, the proceedings start today, from what I understand. I'm sure it's not going to be neutral back and forth between the two parties as they, quote-unquote, interview the justice.
Yeah, so the confirmations start today. They will go all week. Today will be the opening statements. We'll get an opening statement from the chairman, the ranking member, then all of the members on the committee on both sides of the aisle. And we will get an opening statement from Judge Kavanaugh as well. But that will be it for today. We will be questioning starting tomorrow. So today it's reserved for only hot air. That's all there's going to be in these committee meetings today. Expect the Democrats to pull out all the stops, all those old hits about, you know, whether or not Judge Kavanaugh believes that a president is above the law, whether or not, you know, all of that stuff will be part of the Democrats' opening statement. But they're also going to focus on this document quest that they've been going on. If you're going to watch the hearing today, you're going to need to know that the Democrats feel like they have not gotten enough of Judge Kavanaugh's documents from the time that he was in the White House. He served as staff secretary, which meant every important document during the Bush presidency came across his desk. And the Democrats have asked for all of that, which is millions of pages of documents, and they're not going to get it. So I expect that to feature pretty heavily in today's hearing as well.
Well, and compared to Justice Gorsuch, who was confirmed a few months ago, there's reams and reams and reams of decisions from Kavanaugh during his years on the appeals court. And so I assume they are not digging up things for just sort of a neutral interview. There really is. They want to find some evidence for what's already been decided in their minds. The votes have already been decided on both sides before the interviews even start.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the prevailing wisdom here in Washington is that Kavanaugh will be on the court, barring any major surprise. He has 300 decisions on the D.C. Circuit Court, which is more than enough to assess what kind of judge he is. What the other side wants to do is, you know, they want to go on a fishing expedition through his entire career, including his time in the White House, and try to find something that throws mud at him. But the truth is, in the hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that have already been produced and the 300 decisions that he authored on the D.C. Circuit, you can tell what kind of judge he'll be. And that's a judge who bases his decisions on the text of the law and the text of the Constitution. And I'm very happy about that.
Well, what kind of surprise would it take, Tommy, for him to actually not make it? I mean, would it have to be a substantial moral failing or some sort of breaking in the law at this point? It seems like it would have to be a pretty extreme amount of evidence to come against him that would change anybody's opinion.
Yeah, that's right. It would have to be, you know, something really, really bad. And you would think if there was something really, really bad, they would have found it by now because nobody is more heavily vetted than a nominee for the Supreme Court. Nobody. First, the White House does an extreme amount of vetting on them. Then the committee takes over, and of course, the opposition media and the opposition party vet them. So this man has been turned upside down by countless parties trying to find something, and they've come up empty so far. I think that you don't want to count your chickens before they hatch. And so nobody's willing to say, you know, he is definitely going to be confirmed. But they're saying they're confident he'll be confirmed, barring any surprises.
Well, it sounds like out of the 100 senators or so, there's really only five who are ever a question mark. There was three on the Democratic side of the aisle that are in deeply red Republican states that may feel pressure to vote. And then there's a couple moderate Republican senators in Murkowski and Collins that may change their opinion. But do you think at this point, given your understanding of how this works, that that's already as well been decided among those five senators?
Yeah, I would think that they have made up their minds. They've had plenty of time to review his decisions. Many of them have said they've made up their minds. But, you know, I think that that speaks to the quality of this nominee rather than that the Senate is simply entrenched and it was whoever President Trump nominates was going to be confirmed. I don't think that's the case. I think President Trump chose a nominee who was imminently confirmable. And the fact that so few Democrats are willing to admit that is frustrating, but it looks like there are enough Democrats that he's going to get confirmed. When you look at polling, when there's polling in Democratic or in these Democrats who represent red states, when there's polling in their states, it shows that the voters strongly prefer that they vote to confirm this justice.
It's Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation. Tommy, when we come back from break, I want to ask you about the midterm elections that are coming up. And this appointment of the Supreme Court justice might be one of the president's last acts of having a united House and United Senate behind him. And so I'm really curious to get your thought on what seems to be some momentum among the Democratic Party here as we head into the 2018 midterms next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and joined, as I always am on Tuesday mornings, by Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation, talking through the news headlines, specifically out of Washington, D.C. And, Tommy, before the break, I referenced that the midterms obviously are getting closer here in November, and it sounds like the Democrats are sort of covertly behind the scenes planning for the transition. They already have their platforms in place. So kind of talk us through what you see and how likely it is that the Democrats are going to at least take over the House, if not the Senate as well.
Well, I don't know how likely it is. I think after the tumult of the 2016 election, it would be foolish to predict an outcome. So I'm calling it a toss-up, 50-50. I genuinely don't know. There are lots of indicators that indicate the Democrats are going to do well, especially in the House. But in my opinion, there are an equal number of indicators that indicate the Republicans are going to do well. But what's happened here over the last month or so is that the Democrats have begun to plan for taking over the majority. They've begun to, sort of think through what they were going to do in the first 30 days, in the first 90 days, and so on and so forth. So there's been two sort of breaking news items on that in the last couple of weeks. The first was a list of investigations they would launch into President Trump. And it's 20 or 30 items strong. There are that many investigations they want to have into this president. And the second is, I think, a reaction to that story in that they put forth an actual policy agenda. They said that they would be working on health care, covering the cost of health care, which I read massive bailout of Obamacare. They said that they would be doing a large infrastructure spending package, close to $1 trillion in new spending on infrastructure. And the third one would be lobbying and ethics reform. So I think that that's natural in politics. You need to plan to govern. But I think the truth is everybody expects the Democrats to focus on impeachment. And so I'm concerned that what's starting to emerge is a bait and switch, that they're going to run on doing health care, they're going to run on doing infrastructure, and then they're going to spend all their time on that first story, on investigations into the Trump presidency, on impeachment. And they're going to use their majority in 2018 to try to take back the White House in 2020. And I don't think that's fair. I think that's a bait and switch.
Well, and to your point, the policy issues on which they might be running aren't those kinds of things that necessarily make for great headlines. They don't make for pithy statements that people can rally behind. But there is obviously a pretty good section of our country that has a visceral anti-Trump kind of mentality, and they really could end up winning just based on that idea, not necessarily on the policies that they put forth.
I think that's right. When I look at the landscape on the left, I see the sort of Democratic base, you're absolutely right. They hate the president, and they want the Democratic Party to be all about resisting President Trump. But then there is the group in the middle that the Democrats have to appeal to take over the majority in the House. And I don't think they necessarily want that. I think they want to govern. They want to see if the Democrats and President Trump can get together on a few things. This latest story, that's a story for them. They want to hear that the Democrats are interested in something the president is interested in, which is a big infrastructure spending package. They want to see that there's room for compromise between Trump and the Democrats. Unfortunately, you can run like that. You can run appealing to your base and appealing to the middle, but you can't govern like that. You have to choose. Are we going to work with Trump, or are we going to try to impeach him? You really can't do both. And so one of the two groups of people that the Democrats are hoping are going to vote for them in the fall is going to be disappointed by them if they take over the majority in the spring.
Well, in any short-term sort of feeling of when that may happen, if the Democrats do take over the halls of Congress, if they get those 2 years like that, they may actually really set themselves up for failure in 2020, because the president does have a 4-plus percentage growth rate going on in the economy. And if that gets jeopardized, it would be really easy to blame the Democrats in those 2 years then going into the 2020 elections.
Well, I think that's right. I think President Trump right now looks really strong for 2020. He has really high favorability amongst Republicans, and the economy is roaring. Those two things bode very well for him in 2020. The Democrats could definitely help his case by overplaying their hand if they do take over the midterms. And I got to stress, that's a big if. If they do take over the majority after the midterms, they could help Trump if they push too hard, if they try to impeach him over something stupid. This could really backfire.
Well, and to your point, if we didn't learn anything from 2016, we might be in trouble in terms of the reliability of polling. And there is some talk coming out of Washington yesterday in the ongoing feud between Trump and his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, where there were some charges brought forth against some Republican congressional leaders. And Trump actually tweeted out this yesterday that there were two long-running Obama-era investigations of two very popular Republican congressmen brought to charges just ahead of the midterms by Jeff Sessions. Two easy wins in that area, now in doubt because there's not enough time. Good job, Jeff. Now, the sarcasm was dripping in the tweet about this. The president obviously does not like what Jeff Sessions is doing in the Justice Department.
Yeah, that much is clear. and this all started back when Attorney General Sessions, who, remember, helped Trump get elected. Jeff Sessions was one of the first people in Washington to embrace Donald Trump and endorsed him and brought a lot of credibility to his campaign. He recused himself from the investigation having to do with Russia. His deputy, Rod Rosenstein, then appointed special counsel Robert Mueller, and we know how that has gone. So that is the beginning of this of President Trump's problem with Jeff Sessions. And, of course, it's boiled over several times lately over this weekend. This story that President Trump is referring to, though, I'm not sure we should be holding Jeff Sessions accountable to that. It looks like the two congressmen he's referring to really did need to be charged, really did break some fairly significant laws. And I believe in the rule of law, and I'm okay with where this investigation has gone. The timing is frustrating, sure, but these individuals should not be in Congress. If the crimes that they are alleged to have committed, they did indeed commit. So I think we need to keep our focus on the rule of law. Obviously, the president doesn't like the attorney general. We'll see if he's able to replace him. The big question is whether or not the Senate will confirm a new attorney general. For the past year or so, that hasn't been the case. In fact, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, said they wouldn't be able to confirm a new attorney general if the president asked Jeff Sessions to step aside. That may be changing. It may change after the midterms. It may change in 2020. But for now, it's just one of these soap opera things that boils up every now and again.
Tommy, we have just about a minute left or so. Republican Senator Ben Sasse came out, who's been a critic of the administration. He came out and said that the Justice Department should remain politically neutral. He said the United States is not some banana republic with a two-tiered system of justice, one for the majority party and one for the minority. These two men, and to your point, Tommy, have been charged with crimes because of the evidence, not because of who the president was when the investigations began. But, Tommy, we found that a lot of people that are running against the president or seem to be critics of the president and the Republican Party are not finding a future in the political system. They're losing a lot in these special elections and the governorships. Is Ben Sasse at risk for just coming out against the president like this?
Certainly. I think there are a handful of senators who charged hard against the president and then decided that they wouldn't be able to run for re-election, that it got so bad. This president, as I mentioned before, is extraordinarily popular amongst the Republican Party. That said, respectful disagreement, I think, is fine. After all, you know, we can't just have – we don't have a king. We have a president. We have accountability measures. And I think the American people expect that. They learned that, after all, back to the beginning of our segment on Schoolhouse Rock. We have checks and balances. And that's okay. But what I think people are reacting to is the negative politics, the politics of personalization. I think they want to talk about the issues that really matter. That may be there may be some middle ground in this episode between Senator Sasse and President Trump. And I think that's what the people want. They want us to find middle ground and not run to our trenches and throw mud at each other. I'm not sure that that's what Sasse is doing here. I think he's looking for middle ground. I sure hope so. I think that would be a much more popular move.
That's Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation. Tommy, love you joining us here on Tuesday mornings like that. You know, if you're crying a little later this morning as you send your child off to preschool for the first day here, you know, just text me. We can kind of commiserate together. We'll pray through the whole thing.
You bet. I will.
Have a great morning, Tommy. We'll take a break for Lighten Up and Bottom of the Hour News and be joined by Dr. Dale Gentry in the second half of this hour and talk about the ecological impact of the wildfires around our country. Lots more to come on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, for those of us that are parents or grandparents of older kids, we know that university life is back in full swing, and Starbucks has identified the most popular drinks on college campuses. Espresso Frappuccino is the most popular order at Starbucks on college campuses. For college students in the Northeast, Starbucks says it's a white chocolate mocha Frappuccino with an espresso shot. In the Southeast, students prefer it over ice. And in the Southwest, it's an iced triple grande coconut milk latte. I don't even know what that is for sure, but Dale Gentry is in studio. He's a biochemist, and I'm sure he can help me sort out what is in these drinks next on Faith Radio Mornings. Last week on Faith Radio Mornings, we were joined by Justin Holcomb, who is talking to us about the importance and really the purpose of marriage.
Another example of something we should consider when it comes to marriage is, you know, a lot of people in our society see marriage as sort of the capstone to a relationship, right? I mean, how many movies do you watch on television where the end is a wedding? Because it's sort of like that, you know, you've got this couple and they've got to get past all these obstacles, but then finally they get together in the end and they live happily ever after. Marriage in scripture is not the capstone at the end of a long relationship of, you know, living together and doing other things. And now it's sort of, now we've done the final most important thing. Marriage is really, it's not the top of the mountain. The wedding is the bottom of the mountain. And you're going to begin as a couple committed in covenant to one another, moving up this mountain now. And really, scripturally speaking, the top of the mountain for marriage would be, you know, the couple who's been married 50 years.
Great reminders from Justin Holcomb. If you want to find that entire segment, you can head to myfaithradio.com, search for Justin Holcomb or marriage, something along those lines, and catch all of what he had to say last week about the importance of marriage and just even the wonder and beauty of sexuality. Well, lots more to come here in the first hour in Faith Radio Mornings. I see Dr. Dale Gentry is already in studio with us, and we're going to talk about the ecological impact of the massive wildfires that have been happening in California and in Canada next on Faith Radio Mornings.
Children of every race and ethnicity pay a high price when the God-mandated family structure is neglected. This is Jim Garlow. Government can't fix marriages, can't reduce single-parent homes, it can't raise educational scores, even halt gang violence or end poverty. But personal behavioral decisions, especially related to strong marriages and biblical sexuality, will. When we're made aware of a complicated problem, like restoring the traditional family, we get a sense of powerlessness. What can I do? I'm only one person. But you can make a difference, even if it's just one family or one person, as a volunteer tutor or a friend to a child with only one parent. Can you change the world? No. But you can help one person or several in your sphere of influence to embrace and follow God's pattern for the family. Determined to make a difference. There's more at jimgardler.com.
It's about 21 minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined in studio by Dr. Dale Gentry, who is the chair of the Biology and Biochemistry Department here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. And Dale, I read at the bottom of the hour news that, as you know, college is getting back in full swing. Obviously, the campus here is full, and campuses around the country are full again, that Starbucks took it upon themselves to identify the most popular drinks among students. And they said that it's some espresso frappuccino version all around the country that really is the most popular, with the fact in the Southwest, and you have to help me through this, you've got at least a little chemistry in your background here. Yep. It says in the Southwest, it's iced triple grande coconut milk latte. What is in this stuff? Are they putting natural ingredients in this? Is it flavored ingredients? What's happening here in Starbucks?
Oh boy, that's there's a lot going into that. It takes about a half an hour to get that title out, but coconut milk sounds like natural ingredients. Lots of cream and sugar. Hopefully that sounds good, right? That's natural. It must be good for us. But beyond that, yeah, I think there's a heavy dose of syrups with unknown mystery ingredients in those as well, I imagine.
Well, and in those sweeteners category, there's things that like aspartame. There's things of stevia. I see agave.
Yep.
Do you have recommendations for what people should be putting in their bodies relative to some of these sweeteners?
Well, I don't want to get too far off on recommendations because there's actually quite a lot of controversy around those.
Yeah.
There's been some hints or some suggestions that some of those artificial sweeteners might not be good for us. And if you get into the back pages of the dark internet, you'll find people talking about, you know, them being causing cancer and stuff. I don't actually think that's the case, but I do think maybe everything in moderation is wise, and I do try and keep my intakes in what I call natural things. So I eat cream and sugar, but not too much of them. And if I can avoid it, I try and avoid those artificial sweeteners and artificial things. Not because everything artificial is bad, but just because there is a little bit more uncertainty around it. Yeah. I think the fat and the calories are blunt, in your face, you know what to make of them. The artificial stuff, I think when we think we can sweeten everything and have no calories and no consequences, I take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah, there certainly seems to be a long history in the world of maybe trying to find shortcuts, and they don't always work out.
Yes, absolutely.
Various way. Well, thanks for joining us this morning. I know I just last week we got home from holiday, and we live in the Minneapolis St. Paul area, and I got home and got out of my car, mm-hmm. and it smelled almost like somebody was burning something in our home. We do have a natural wood-burning fireplace, and it really smelled like our home can smell, where there gets to be some smoke. And I thought, what is happening? Is there a fire going on? What's taking place? But it sounds like that these massive forest fires that are going on in California, or have been going on in Canada, that the smoke from these is capable of blowing all across the United States. So talk us through that, and even some of the maybe temperature impact, ecological impact that a country might see, even though the forest fires are a couple thousand miles away. I know this is your background as an ecologist.
Sure, yeah. That jet stream is powerful, and so when that smoke gets airborne, it can go wherever the jet stream takes it. But the fires are really quite contentious. I grew up in southern Idaho, which is a hotbed for forest fires, and we experience those every fall and summer. And it's actually quite a fascinating history. When you think about forest fires, I just ask the audience, what's the first thing that comes to mind? I imagine for many of us, it's Smokey, right? Smokey the Bear, the fire preventing bear, who did a very effective public campaign convincing us all that forest fires are a bad thing, a terrible thing. We should do everything we can to avoid them and prevent them. And we decided that societally about 100 years ago, and started doing everything we could to put out every forest fire, thinking that just that's the right thing to do. That's what we should do. It's going to be for the good of the people that live around there, and for the good of the forest, without thinking forward a few years. And so now we look back at those forests where we've been putting out fires, and have discovered that what's left over is this buildup of what we call a fuel load in ecology, meaning there's just lots of things that can burn. And so when you do have these natural or, you know, human-caused fires, they are so hot and so fierce and just unlikely to be put out because there's so much fuel in the forest that that they are much more prone to grow out of control.
Hmm.
So there's that aspect. You know, the changing climate probably has something to do with this as well, the hotter circumstances and some of the droughts that seem to be associated with a changing climate are exacerbating that, as well as just human causing some of these. We certainly have lightning strikes, and a lot of them are natural fires, but it seems for whatever reason, almost theologically, the ones that cause the most problems are the ones that humans are at fault in. And in California, I know that's the case that been this summer.
And as part of that, just the expanding population where humans are beginning to live in areas that historically were more remote and uninhabited. And because that's true, there gets to be some environmental impact.
Yeah, probably some of that and just sort of a little bit of carelessness and making poor decisions when we're out in the woods. A lot of it's accidental, but certainly a lot that's it's just kind of foolish. We hear, you know, people playing with fire or you know, driving or being in places where they shouldn't be and starting off fires.
If I'm breathing in some of the smoke that is sort of wafting across our country mm-hmm. now, I understand that there can be a pretty significant negative health impact for me. What happens if we're breathing in smoke like that all day long? I mean, sometimes I even see photos out of places in Asia. It's not going to be fire-based smoke, but then there's smog people are wearing their masks.
Yep.
I mean, what are we inhaling? Does there need to be some concern when there really does get to be these smoke levels that are wafting around the country?
Yeah, it certainly can be harmful to your lungs. So if you think smoke is basically little, almost microscopic particles of ash. So we all see ash. You have your fire and the remnants of what doesn't burn. And when that ash gets sort of broken up into small particles and goes airborne, that's smoke. When you get those little particles into your lung, that's really no different from smoking a cigarette. You're getting little ash particles in your lungs. Those little particles are going to cause minute tears in the tissues in your lungs. Your lungs are going to have to repair those tears. And so, if you take in enough of it, it can do great harm. And so, you know, growing up out west, there's certainly an awareness of times when not to go outside if there's really heavy smoke in the air. I think what we're experiencing in Minnesota, things blowing in from Canada and the west, probably not enough to cause as much of a concern. But certainly, if you know people that are living in those areas, there's a lot to be they should be aware of.
If you're a parent of a child maybe that has some asthma or you have some asthma yourself, could that be a possibility of maybe a little extra layers of protection?
Absolutely, yeah. Yep. People with asthma, emphysema, any lung condition like that, certainly it's going to exacerbate those conditions.
It's Dr. Dale Gentry, who's the chair of biology and biochemistry here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul, specializes in ecology as well. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us or text in at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And Dale, when we come back from break, I would love to just ask you about the aftermath of these fires mm-hmm. and with this massive loss of trees. I'm not the biologist or the ecologist, but I do understand trees bring oxygen into our world. That's about the extent of it. And I'd love to know just sort of the impact moving forward when these things happen.
Yep.
So lots more to come here with Dr. Dale Gentry on Faith Radio Mornings. It's about 10 minutes for the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner and Dr. Dale Gentry is in studio. And we're just talking about the various impact that wildfires have on us around our country, even around the world. And Dale, I know I think often of the aftermath of these fires, and we're just talking thousands and thousands and thousands of acres burned. Mm-hmm. What does the landscape look like then in the next year or two or three? What kind of impact does the loss of trees have? What happens in these years after the fire?
Yeah, a lot is going on, actually. Anybody that's been to Yellowstone National Park in the past 20 years would recognize how those landscapes recover after the fire, you know, the famous fire that, you know, wiped out half of Yellowstone. And if you went back in the first couple of years, you just saw these totems, you know, these standing dead scorched trees, and it looks like kind of devoid of life. But in many cases, if you come back 3 or 4 years later, you're going to see a bunch of young trees that pop up. Now, this really varies a lot with the type of forest. So there are certain forests that really thrive with fire. Yellowstone is the perfect example of that. It's a lodgepole pine forest. Many of those trees actually reproduce best with fire. And it almost like God designed them to thrive with fire. And there are a lot of ecosystems like that. If you go out to the Black Hills, South Dakota, Ponderosa Pine Forests in Colorado and South Dakota, and actually all over the West, but that's an ecosystem that also likes fire, but it likes low-intensity fires like every 15 or 20 years. So really frequent fires, but it doesn't kill the trees. And in a lot of those dry forest ecosystems, that's natural, right? The frequent low-intensity fires clears out the understory. It's actually really good for wildlife, but it doesn't kill the trees. And what we're seeing now, as I mentioned, you know, this buildup of fuels over the past century that's causing what used to be those low intensity frequent fires are turning into high intensity fires that wipe out the whole forest. And so, and you know, in the years following, the trees do come back. I think we, you know, sometimes we're a little heartbroken to go through there and we've lost the shade and we've lost some of the wildlife, but some of the wildlife really likes the fires. And so, you know, one of the messages I try and tell my students is that fires can be tragic if people die or people's homes are consumed. They can be tragic in some ecosystems, but in many circumstances, they're good. And I think when we think about stewardship, what we are now striving towards as we've learned our lesson a little bit is to allow fires burn when they're good fires and put out the ones that are putting people's lives and homes at risk. And try and have the discernment to be able to tell the difference between the two.
Well, I think that's a fascinating concept, actually, because when I hear and see fire and watch the news reports, I'm immediately thinking, put it out. But right. It's like, you know, I get a stray spark at our bonfire on a Friday night, and immediately
Smokey the Bear did his job. He convinced you,
exactly.
Right? It's a terrible thing. Yep.
Well, but what you're suggesting is that properly contained and controlled, there really is a stewardship aspect of this that God maybe even hardwired fire into creation to do sort of this cleansing, kind of refining sort of work.
Absolutely, yeah, yep. And we're actually to the point where we're lighting fires now intentionally. Some people are probably aware of this and see it, and others are shocked and surprised by it. Especially in like prairie ecosystems, they love fire, and they, you know, we think that in the tall grass prairies before they were turned into farmland, they probably burned every 2 or 3 years. It was just a healthy, natural thing for the fire. It takes a lot of the nutrients that are trapped, and trapped is the wrong word, but are found in those, you know, the dead plants, and it returns them back into the soil. And we actually think that historically we know that Native Americans used a lot of fire, and at least part of the reason is that in post-fire landscapes, the plants that grow are literally more nutritious. And you usually find deer and elk and bison loving to spend time in those areas that were burned 2 or 3 years ago because there's a lot of good, healthy forage for them.
Do we see the same kind of impact, or is it more of a negative impact, say, maybe in places like South America with the rainforest? And we're talking about an intentional man-made wiping out of thousands of acres of trees. Do we see positive benefit from that, or are we really talking about fire being a natural dimension of this that's helpful, but maybe not so much the man-made destruction?
Yeah, you know, the deforestation is really different in that, you know, in the fires, usually it burns and then it grows back. And so we call that, in ecology, we call that succession. So it's changing from a mature forest, now it's a baby forest, and it's going to grow back to be a mature forest again. And we actually find lots of wildlife that sort of preferred those different stages. Some wildlife really like to be in the forests that were burned 5 or 10 years ago, and then by the time the forest is mature, they're gone. And so, as a wildlife ecologist, we say, hey, some of those fires are really good because those animals that like the recently burned habitats have a place to live. But if you're just removing the trees and, you know, usually replacing it with, you know, with buildings or agriculture or something, yeah, then you lose that benefit because you don't have a habitat left over after the logging.
Mm. Well, Dale, I'd be remiss to let you run before I ask you a question about fall gardening prep. You know, we've got a garden at home. You're the ecology guy, and I don't exactly know what to do to prepare the garden for the frozen tundra that will become the Midwest here, where we live. And any tips for helping us sort of just prepare our garden for spring growing season now?
In the fall is a good time to be spreading compost and putting out a layer of, you know, straw or mulch or something along those lines. That'll usually help with preventing spring weeds. I usually try not to do any tilling in the fall. I'm actually getting to the point where I'm doing much less tilling overall in my garden, but that's kind of you know, different takes on whether you should till it or not. But yeah, you know, that's what I emphasize is just some compost and some straw or some mulch of some sort. And then I also have gotten in the habit, instead of pulling out my plants, I cut them off at soil level, because those roots that are in the soil, when those decompose the next year, they're going to actually, you know, add something back into the soil. Whereas if you just pull them out, then you're losing some of that organic matter in the soil. So more work, of course. We like to make it hard on people, but if you can leave the roots in the soil, it's good for the previous or for the following years.
That's fascinating. If you could just come spend the next few weekends at my house and help sort this out, that'd be great. Well, I know you're heading up to a lab here in just a little bit for biology lab as we're all back to school, but really appreciate you joining us, kind of talking through the ecological impact of fire, and that really does have a positive benefit. So have a great rest of your morning, Dale.
Yeah. Thanks, same to you.
We'll be back in just a minute and wrap up the first hour of our show. Love the conversation with Dr. Gentry just about environmental issues. We did have a caller call in and ask whether or not climate change is a man-made phenomenon, whether it's a natural phenomenon, or even if it's happening at all. That one, of course, gets a little dicey, but I was just talking during the break here, Dr. Gentry, you'd be willing to come back in a couple weeks and address this with us.
Yeah, I would love to. You know, it's a really complex, really fascinating, really relevant topic, and the answer is some of both. You know, the climates can change naturally, and they do, and so that leads us to ask, is that what's happening now? And I'd say there's good evidence to say that it's at least some of it right now is a consequence of our actions as well.
Well, I would love to have you back and talk about that conversation. Have a great time at your biology lab, and we'll get set up for the second half of our show here. Dr. David Stevens will be joining us next at the top of the hour on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.